The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. Happy New Year to everyone. This week, we are offering up two of our favorite conversations from 2016, plus a wonderful story that journalist-writer Maynard Hirshon has spun for us in the past. First up is Jeremy Powers, one of the top pro cyclocross racers ever. In my conversation with him back in October, we chatted about whether the rumors of his retirement are true, what happened in a key race in Iowa, and what he likes to eat. He also shared some very interesting ideas about our sport of cycling. Jeremy's was one of the most liked interviews on our show this year. After a short musical interlude, we'll come back with my August interview with the ever-active Shannon Galpin, arguably one of the bravest and most inspiring women with whom I've ever spoken. Her work with the women in Afghanistan stands as a testament to the sheer will of someone who just won't take no for an answer. Her Afghan women's cycling team was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize, and her work has earned her a National Geographic Adventurer of the Year Award. She's one of my favorite people in our world of cycling. And then we'll close out 2016 with the retelling of Maynard Hirshon's Nice Wheels. I first heard the story many years ago. I've heard it several times since, and I never get tired of it. Of course, Maynard's telling of it is what makes it so much better. Lastly, I would like to wish you a very happy, healthy, and peaceful new year. Here is my conversation with Jeremy Powers. So let us welcome superstar cyclocross champion Jeremy Powers to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for taking time to speak with me today.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
It's my pleasure. So here's the word on the street. You're retiring. Yeah. Is that BS or what?
Well, you know, No. I'm definitely not retiring. I think, I'm not exactly sure how that all probably got started. But, I mean, you know, the general thing that's happening in cyclocross right now is there's a lot of young riders coming up. And so 33 is not very old. That's how old I am. But it looks like, you know, I've gone through a couple of generations of cyclocross riders and racers. And so, obviously, a logical step that the media has been asking me a lot recently is when I'm, you know, going to hang it up. And just a recent article on Cycling Tips was, you know, dubbed it as the autumn of my cycling career, so like kind of the last hurrah. And I'm not surprised by that. It's totally fine, but I definitely I have a plan for the next at least 2 years and potentially a third year. So I'm not really focused on retirement quite yet.
I just think it's funny that rumors start and, you know, one person picks it up and it's sort of like when you played telephone as a kid and comes out the other end and it doesn't sound anything like what you thought it would.
Yeah, that is for sure. I've seen that happen 100 times, so I always try to go straight to the source. So I appreciate you asking me. And, yeah, the facts are the facts, and I'm not planning to retire, definitely not this year and definitely not next year. So.
Okay, you heard it here. So there. I would like to know how you came to be so interested in cyclocross, that became your focus.
Yeah, over the years, I trended towards, I've always had a pretty short attention span, even when I was really young. I was a classic kid in school that really couldn't pay attention. And later in my high school years, I would front load a lot of my classes so that I would do them in the morning, kind of on a fresh off sleep, and basically head right to class, kind of do my harder classes first thing in the morning, and then I would go home and train in the afternoons. And so I was really lucky to have that. And I noticed when I was racing junior mountain bikes that the races that were an hour 20 minutes long, I would do really well in. And then mountain biking, because that's what I was doing when I first started off, it was, the races started to go more towards an hour and 40 out, 2 hours, 220. And that didn't suit me as well. And so really, I raced on the road for a long time. And it was really great for my engine, but really any race that was over 100K or 3 hours, maybe 330, I really didn't do well in it. It's mainly because I just, my attention span was shorter just genetically. And that was the gift that was given. So cyclocross has kind of always been the thing that I've really gravitated towards and had a lot of success in, combining the technical aspects as well as the explosive power. And I've always loved it. I've always loved all of the little bits of it that are different than the other disciplines of cycling that I've done.
Well, you certainly have had a ton of success throughout your career with it. I have to say, I was a little bit surprised to read your Instagram post a few days ago. I think listeners would be interested to hear about it because it shows that even the very best of cyclists, those who are trained well, who have tons of successes, experience bad days or bad situations. Tell us what happened in Iowa.
Yeah, so so just to provide some context for the listeners, basically this was kind of the big week of cyclocross in the United States. We started off last weekend. There's a Category 1 race that's in that was at Trek headquarters in Waterloo, Wisconsin, which was last Sunday. So not this past Sunday, but the Sunday before that, where a lot of European riders hadn't been invited over, and Trek was sort of taking care of to have them come and race in the United States. So that was sort of our first shot at racing against the Europeans. On American soil, in many years, probably, at least at this clip. So we did, we had that first race, and in warm-up, I actually crashed pretty hard on my left rib cage and on my left arm, and I jumped up really quickly, sort of hoping that it wasn't going to be very much and that I was going to be able to walk it off, but I soon realized that that wasn't going to be the case, and I was almost immediately within, an hour and the hours after that, I was very, very sore from basically the fall. And so that kind of led me to the World Cup in Las Vegas, which was that Wednesday after that. And then after that, we had Iowa. And so, by the time Iowa came, all of those injuries had sort of fully matured, I guess I'd say, and I was in quite a bit of pain and, labored breathing, and just the additional running that was on the course in Iowa versus something like Las Vegas. I was in a lot of pain, and I was on the tail end of a head cold too. So I was just starting to get this head cold. Actually, it is the wrong way to say that, but basically I just had a head cold starting kind of at that same moment, and really just kind of a disastrous week of racing altogether. And it's too bad because the week before I had good form and I had actually won both days at the season opener in Rochester, New York. And so then, you fast forward to 1 week later and I really had like just a terrible week of racing with an injury and then a head cold. And so, it's kind of hard to believe so much has happened, but we're really only going into the third weekend of cyclocross season coming up. So
that's what's interesting is how huge this race schedule is. It's all piled on in this very short period of time. How do you stay fresh and prepared and fit for so many events that are so close together?
Yeah, American cyclocross is a little different. Like the Europeans do take a more traditional approach, but they get very heavy in their season. I would say more towards October, November, December, they have a lot of racing. In the United States, we really trend towards September, October, November are our strongest months. And then a lot of riders, we do have some races in the beginning of December, big races, and then we have the national championships in January. But really, like the last couple of weeks of December and then anything after nationals is really small. And so we all end up having or do end up racing over in Europe, the final World Cups and then the World Championships and sort of the season accumulate are kind of culminates at the end where the World Championships are right at the first weekend of February. So how do you stay fresh? really, for American cyclocross rider to come into the season in good condition in September is really important. And, you know, and then it's about taking kind of breaks and really knowing oneself to be able to, I would say, meter the outputs and really choose, pick and choose where they want to put their energy in what events.
Do you subscribe to any particular diet? I know people always talk about food, so, you know, we ride to eat, right? So,
right. Yeah, I've said that a lot. You know, I do find myself, I've tried many different diets, and as I have, you know, since the beginning of this conversation was about getting older, as I've gotten older, my diet has absolutely changed. You know, I think when you're younger, you can really, I would say, you know, digest carbohydrate really quickly, and almost nothing kind of phases you, to, you know, dairy, lactose, all of these things. And as you get older, you start to look for, I would say, improvements in other, like, in other ways, you know. So can I race this, you know, hour and 10-minute race in a different way? Can I race it, you know, do, if I'm not as good at the start, but I am really good at the finish, should I race, you know, thinking differently about it? Is my diet something that I can do? Can I get more in the gym, and can I build up? These are all things. And so my diet has absolutely changed. I've trended towards less carbohydrate in the last year, I would say. You know, even at one point going into like a ketogenic type diet through the base season, but that didn't really yield the result that I wanted for my high end output. So I do have like a lot less sugar in my diet overall. And that's been really good for me. I have I feel like mental clarity. I feel really good. And I think that I have plenty of available, I guess, carbohydrate or like glycogen storage, if you will. So I feel great on the bike. And I think I've made good decisions about my diet. And in general, I try to eat things that are good for you. And so if I see something in my diet, you know, I track it every, you know, a couple times a month. Just do like a small, you know, basically like MyFitnessPal. I just kind of enter in what I'm eating. And then if I see things that just don't look like they're really nutritious, I try to, you know, kind of remind myself that that's not a good use of calories at this point. Because really when you're a cyclist, you have to be, you know, a high-end cyclist. You really need to be thinking about every calorie that you eat and what its benefit to you is. So.
All good advice, I would say. So yeah. we're going to actually talk about a couple of other things. But one of the things I wanted to know was, I've seen it for years and years and years, that cyclists especially seem to undermine their own successes sometimes. And I'm wondering if you think that that's so, and what might cause that?
Well, give me an example of what you mean, and then I'll jump on it.
Okay, like, here's the guy who in training is just the fastest, and he always knows when to shift, what to do. Gets out in a race, drops his chain. Just seems to not be able to come across the line.
Sure.
You know, in the front. Do you know what I'm saying? Kind of.
Definitely. Yeah, and I think a lot of riders, you know, sometimes we'll say like, you know, I'll joke with like friends, like, man, their head fell off.
Oh, okay. That's a good way to put it.
You know, like headless horsemen out there. But, you know, I think for a lot of riders, there is a mental component to it that is really hard to overcome and is something that I feel as though I've had, a lot of opportunities to race at the highest end. So when I speak for myself, I feel comfortable when I line up for a World Cup, and I've been able to execute at that level many times, whether or not my fitness has been there or whether I've been struggling through a long season with a lot of travel. I kind of file those in different folders. But I would say for a lot of riders, you know, you really do go through different steps in your career, and looking at those things and being honest and having a lot of like self-awareness around, am I actually kind of sabotaging myself, sort of like what you said, by not really addressing this fear or this underlying cause that's, you know, having me make bad decisions in the race, whether that's erratic shifting or not knowing like a speed limit coming into a turn and then end up crashing, or, you know, not, you know, getting to the race with enough time and being stressed out. A lot of things come into being a good rider and a complete rider. And so I always really, you know, those are the kinds of things that when you become a pro, you know, you hope that you've learned. And some riders have so much talent that they turn pro really quickly. And that's the type of stuff that when you hear riders say, yeah, I stayed one more year in the amateur so I could learn more, or I stayed one more year in the United States with this team so that I could learn more, like a 20-year-old staying on, you know, like Axel Merckx's program. That's a good thing, because when you get to the pro tour, that stuff doesn't fly. They don't look at you and think, oh, yeah, I'd really like to like get you in with a mental coach so that you can work on this thing, or like we can talk about your diet. No, it's like you're there to perform, and you're being paid, you know, to do a job and to execute. So, yeah, I guess I guess that would be my advice, is like making sure that you're the full package, and knowing and having that self-awareness around where your weaknesses are is a really valuable thing in life and also as a cyclist, for sure.
I want to remind our listeners, we're speaking with superstar Jeremy Powers. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. I want to ask you something that I think is really important to the health of cycling in general. It's an expensive sport to get into. You have an organization, a cycling foundation called JAM, J-A-M. I want to know what it is and what it does, because I think it addresses that particular question for maybe some future superstars who find it very daunting to get into the sport.
Absolutely, yeah. And so JAM is an acronym from the first names of my two best friends, Alec and Mukunda. So Jeremy, Alec, and Mukunda is what, you know, the acronym is JAM. And it's just JAM Cycling Fund. And essentially, JAM is, I very simply sometimes say that it is an organization that, like, kicks down the financial barriers that are, you know, like, inherent in cycling, right? And we know this because it's, you can go out and buy a pair of running shoes or buy, you know, a baseball and a glove or whatever. These are much less expensive sports to get into. Whereas cycling, you know, there isn't a barrier of entry for sure. And so I think I was very lucky in being able to, I would say, self-promote and really, like, put myself out there. If I wanted to be on a team, or I wanted the manager of the team, whether it worked out or not, to know who I was, I talk a lot. So even when I was younger, it was worse. So I would be at the races and I would be just like clawing at these people, just like, "Hey, John," this was the owner of the team, the mountain bike team, Team Vivo, that I was part of. "Hey, John, I'm Jeremy Powers." Like, immediately after the race, I got 29th today and I'm 13th, you know, in the expert category. And so these types of things, like really putting yourself out there and really, I say self-promotion, and I think a lot of people look down on that, but in this sport, really, you have to self-promote. You have to talk about your accomplishments, or you have to talk about your desire to get in that place. JAM Fund takes a lot of what Alec and McKenna and I have learned from life as cyclists, and just life skills across the board, whether that's cooking rice for yourself and making eggs in the morning before the race, or that's, like, you know, knowing how to register and, you know, sign yourself up for a massage locally, or whatever, like all of these things. We sort of have a formula for the JAM Fund that we've passed down to other riders. And I think we've turned 6 riders here in our little area of Massachusetts professional, and they all live and train here. And we've created a community. And really, deep down, I think that we just genuinely like helping people, and we really want to see other people succeed. And, you know, for a long time, that was our passion, was to see JAM Fund fully through, to make sure that other riders had the same opportunities, and that, you know, money and logistics and travel and stuff like that, that we could help and give back in that way. And so we've had some success with it. We're not done by any stretch with JAM. It's been a great run. We're starting to really see some, I would say, the fruit of that tree kind of starting to bear, because Stephen Hyde has been riding really well, and he's a rider that came from that. You know, he just raced to 10th in Iowa at the World Cup. Ellen Noble is leading the under-23 World Cup right now, and she is a product of that. Jeremy Duren's a product of that. Anthony Clark, and there's others. So it's been such a great thing to do, and I say that it's way bigger than me. I have a small role in it. You know, I do a part of it, but really, Alec is really the heart of that program. He takes all the riders to the races, and he helps them, and together we create, you know, what is JAM. And so it's been really special to have that impact in our little community and in the cyclocross community in general.
Well, it's obvious that it's a give back, and, you know, giving back, paying it forward, those are all important things. And I think it makes a lot of sense in cycling, because it's such a tough sport. You know, there are a lot of components to it that a lot of people don't see. You know, oh, you just jump on a bike and ride. No, it's not that easy. So,
yeah, and I'll just add really quickly, like, I've always said, you know, and some people really hold these secrets, I would say, close to their chest, because they really don't want it to get out there. And it's so hard, as you said, to make it in cycling, that really, like, it's, if you know us, it's we're an open book, and really everything we know, all the training, all the nutrition, everything that we do, we really give it all to the riders so that they can make it, because we believe we have a formula that's at least strong. You know, we don't say it's like the best, but even giving them all the information, it would be so hard for them to make it. So we understand that, and we really try to make great riders and in general, great people out of from the Jam Fund. So
yeah, I think that's really cool. Great people. You know, it's true that you are a writer, but before that, you are a human being. So, where are you headed after KMC? I mean, I know it's a huge season. You're heading for World Cup stuff, right?
Yep. So I'll do in theory. I mean, I have currently I'm battling off a little bit of a head cold and some bruised ribs. Luckily, I just came out of the doctor's office and they're not broken, so I'm pretty happy to get that. So it's just going to be some time there with some pain, but not broken, which is great. So yeah. So I guess KMC is TBD, to be determined whether or not I'll be able to line up. I won't know until Saturday. After that, for sure, 100%, I'm going to do Baltimore, which is the Charm City race. It's a Category 1 race there on Saturday. I'll be racing. Sunday I'll be racing there in Charm City. And then I'm going to come back and we'll do a one day at Gloucester. And then the next couple days after that, Ellen and I will both travel to the World Cup in the Netherlands, which is in Valkenburg. And then we come back and we have the Pan American Championships, which is in Cincinnati. We do 2 days of racing there. And it kind of just continues from there. Louisville, and then we have a trip back to Europe after that, 2 weeks after that. So, it's very fast paced.
Yeah, I was hoping that Cincinnati would be closer to next weekend because that's Recumbent CycleCon's down there, and I'm going to be down there. I would be able to catch up with you, but that's not going to work. So these are going to be the silly questions. What's your favorite food?
I really love breakfast. So, you know, eggs in a thousand different ways with some vegetables, maybe some bacon sometimes, avocados, things like that. Breakfast is easily the meal that I look forward to every day the most because I think I'm pretty much, I'm starving when I go to sleep. So I'm like, I can't wait to wake up and eat something.
That's funny because I like breakfast too. And you can have breakfast anytime, you know. You don't have to have breakfast in the morning.
I know. That always gets me at the races, the diners. They always get me.
Right. Exactly. So what's your favorite kind of music? Do you play? I mean, I obviously you probably listen to music when you train. What's your favorite kind of music?
Yeah, I would say a younger version of myself. I always wished I had gone to like a lot of the music festivals and kind of been out there doing that type of, I don't know, just like partying, like hanging out with friends, you know, enjoying yourself and just seeing like live music shows. I never did that because I was always so focused on my racing. So I listened to a lot of live sets from a lot of DJs and electronic DJs. And there's a lot of big festivals, especially, you know, in the States now and in Europe. So I download a lot of those live sets and I listen to them and I kind of just, I go with that. I love old school hip hop, like depending on what it is. I was a really big fan of DJ AM before he passed away and I listened to a lot of his sets. When I'm training, I still do. They're just classics in the DJ world. So, I would say I'm a little like, I don't listen to classical music, but, one thing I did do this year that's probably interesting is I started listening to a lot of podcasts and a lot of book on tape. And so, yeah, I think I listened to instead of, you know, as much music, I probably listened to hundreds of hours of podcasts and books this year, which was a big change for me.
So, well, maybe eventually you'll add mine to your list.
That's right. I'm
that
definitely
would be nice.
Getting familiar with yours.
Yeah. So the last thing I have to ask has to do with my favorite topic, besides bicycles. Do you have a pet?
I do, yeah. My dog is a yellow lab. He's 5 years old. His name is Moose. Also goes by Monster. Crazy man, a lot of things, but he is a, you know, classic, like purebred Labrador. He's a total crazy, you know, he's total crazy, but he has a good temperament and he's not like wild, like he doesn't, you know, he's not doing crazy things. He's well mannered, but gosh, we love him. And when you get a dog, I hate to say this, but like, you always know, like, man, just, I'm going to love this. Like, I love this guy.
That's
so,
right.
Yeah. It's, for sure. I look forward to every time I get to hang with him. And just even last night, just like, you know, sick. He just wants to nuzzle, like put his head underneath your armpit and just watch TV with you. And it's just a, you know, man's best friend, if you will.
That is so true. That
yeah,
is so
always
true.
Excited to come home and be with the dog and my wife, Emily, as well.
Well, and your dog will always love you forever and ever and ever and ever. Is always happy to see you. Well, Jeremy, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today. Good luck. I hope those ribs heal up. And good luck with the World Cup races, all the races. And have a wonderful season.
Thank you, Diane. Thank you for having me. And thanks, everyone, for listening.
Take care of yourself.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. The interview you just heard with Jeremy Powers and me was originally aired on October 1st, 2016. We're going to take a short break and we'll come back with my August 27th conversation with Shannon Galpin. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
On January 21st and 28th, Lake Erie Inc., a writing space for youth, and Dobama Theater are teaming up to host a two-part youth playwriting workshop. Finished works will be submitted to the Marilyn Bianchi Kids Playwriting Festival, which accepts original play submissions from 1st through 12th graders from Cuyahoga County and then produces the winning plays at their summer festival. Young writers will have the chance to work with internationally known playwright Katie O'Keefe during this two-part workshop. A small registration fee is required. Registration and more information at lakeerieinc.org.
We're back, and we're going to go out to my August 27th conversation and hear my interview with National Geographic's Adventurer of the Year in 2015 and founder of the Women's Afghan Cycling Team, Shannon Galpin. Hi, Shannon. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me today.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
It is my pleasure. So we've always talked about the women's cycling team in Afghanistan and mountain to mountain. And, of course, we paid you the ultimate, or you were paid the ultimate compliment, being Adventurer of the Year by National Geographic. But it's been a while since we had a conversation. I thought it would be a good time to catch up. Things are happening in the Middle East. The first thing I'd like to talk about is something you posted on your site yesterday, your Facebook page. What's going on in Kabul, and has the situation gotten any better?
Unfortunately, the situation in Kabul and throughout most of Afghanistan is steadily progressing in the wrong direction. And yesterday, there was kind of proof of that with a major attack against the American University in Kabul. And this is where a lot of friends, a lot of young people that I know in Kabul go to university. It was the first week of school. And at this particular count, it looks like 12 have died. And I'm still getting news in. Many were injured. And so it was just a kind of, I guess, this perfect finger pointing at how the Taliban are really targeting the youth and the next generation and specifically education. And it's heartbreaking to watch that unfold and to watch, certainly on Facebook and social media, where so many young Afghans are, you know, them looking for their friends and mourning the friends that were killed. And that's not what should be happening at a university anywhere.
So the Taliban did take responsibility?
I believe they have, yes.
Yeah. Well, we can only send our good intentions to those who are mourning and who are grieving. It's really, really sad. It's just unbelievable for people like us who live in a country where school is, you know, almost taken for granted in a way.
Oh, definitely. And I think it's just another sign that, you know, the youth of Afghanistan are really where the hope is. You know, the education, you know, they're activists. They're really pushing boundaries and really wanting to have, there's a lot of voice around anti-corruption and other issues that face their country, and the youth really want to have a voice. And so when you see attacks like this that are specifically targeting, you know, that next generation, it's even more heartbreaking than when it's a government institution or a military target.
Well, in addition to youth, we've got women's rights being trampled on yet again, very much in the spotlight this week. There was the incident in France where police insisted a woman bather remove her burkini while she was on the beach. So what's your take on what women are going through right now? This was in France, not in the Middle East.
Exactly. I mean, it's this incredible sign that women are being told around the world what they can or cannot wear, what they should or should not do, and that this is not just an issue in countries where we look at Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, Iran, where, you know, women have certain dictates around what they should wear, that they should wear the hijab, that in Afghanistan they need to wear a burqa or they need to, you know, wear a hijab. It is a massive rollback in freedoms in a country that really has always purported itself to be the symbol of liberty and equality. And I think that's what makes it all the more shocking, is that it is in France, and that here you have a woman who's just laying on the beach enjoying her right like everyone else. Who cares what she's wearing? What she's wearing has nothing to do with anything. And, you know, it's just a constant reminder that women are told around the world what they can wear.
So do you have any idea who perpetrated that? I mean, there are women in France laying on the beach with nothing on. I mean, that is more offensive.
Yeah.
That's more offensive to me than a woman in a burkini. I'm sorry. There are some women who should not be seen naked.
Well, and it's the fact of if you're allowing women to go to the extreme of you have topless, which is throughout a lot of beaches in Europe, you certainly should then also allow women to be fully clothed should they choose to. And the irony, I think, is the fact that we have attacks against women's rights coming from both sides. And that's what I find really fascinating, particularly when we tie it back to sports. You have women who are being told they cannot participate in sports unless they are fully clothed, they wear the hijab, and that often that is a barrier for their participation. And yet we also have, right now, we have a situation where there is an incredible basketball player, she's Muslim American, who is not allowed to go pro as a basketball player because the International Federation, I can't remember what it's called, it's the FIFA, essentially, of basketball, has a hijab ban. So here's a woman who can't go pro because she chooses to wear hijab, and yet other places that are forcing women to wear hijabs. And, you know, so you can't win.
Yeah, right. It sounds like a no-win situation. But let's talk about something positive, because a couple of positive things did happen this week, especially. The first Iranian woman triathlete is headed to Kona in a few weeks. And I know there were some challenges to her race clothing, her, you know, swimsuit, her running, her biking. There are two designers who evidently stepped up and resolved the issue. What do you know about her tri clothing?
Well, so it's really fascinating when we're talking about what women must wear to compete. And Shirin Gharami was the first and so far the only female triathlete to compete. She's British-Iranian. She's lobbied hard and really fought to have the right to compete as an Iranian in a country that really was not going to allow that, particularly because of the swim. And she has to race fully clothed in order to represent Iran. And Kona is a situation where it's not a national race. It's an individual. But she wants to prove that you can race fully covered so that if she can show that, one, it's possible to race at that level fully covered, that she can open up some more doors for other Iranian and Middle Eastern women that want to race covered. And what we found is, you know, certainly what she had kind of cobbled together before for an outfit was super hot. It did not breathe very well. It met the standards of what Iran needed for them to approve her to race under the Iranian Federation. But I introduced her to my dear friend Alan Lim at Scratch Lab, and he then introduced her, and we brought a whole team together of literally like the best and the best of fabric designers with 37.5 who are creating fabric and at a yarn level that actually would keep you cooler than not wearing clothes, because it's maximizing your skin's ability to stay cool when it sweats. And then pattern cutter. Wow, I couldn't say that. And an incredible designer who has worked with Roka in the past, which is a really amazing swim company that works with triathletes. And so we all kind of got together. Sharon showed us what she was already wearing and what she needed, and really brainstorming how to, in what is now looking to be about 5 weeks till she heads to Kona, how to very quickly custom design her tri gear that she could then essentially do the R&D for during Kona. So it's really positive. It's really exciting. And it's, for me, fascinating to be able to be behind the scenes and watch this go. She's an incredible, incredible force of nature. She's so positive, and she just believes anything is possible. So we're discussing collaborating on a few things post-Kona.
Well, she looks great in it. First of all, she's beautiful. Let's start with that.
She is stunning. And I really, I think what that's coming from is that her heart matches her face. It's incredible.
Obviously. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Shannon Galpin. She is the force behind the Afghan women's cycling team, which we will talk about in a moment. She was also National Geographic's Adventurer of the Year. And her nonprofit organization is Mountain to Mountain. That's mountain, the number two, mountain.org. I wonder, and this is an opinion from you, how do you think women who want the freedom of choice can still remain loyal to, like, their religions and their countries and still exercise that freedom? Hard question, huh?
It's a really hard question. And I've talked with a lot of female athletes that I know. I sit on the board of advisors for this group called Shirzanon Global, and Shirzanon means heroes in Persian, or female heroes in Persian. And it's allowed me to meet a lot of women, not just Afghan, but Saudi Arabian and Iranian and Pakistani women that all are really different in terms of how they choose or don't choose to practice their religion. How they identify themselves, are they covered or uncovered as athletes? And it's such a personal choice, but all of them, you know, have struggled with the duality that they must inhabit. Shiz in particular, Shiz is Shirin Jarami's nickname, the Iranian triathlete. We've talked a lot about it because she was raised in Britain. She's not covered when she's in Britain. She's not covered when she goes out and trains. She's covered in order to compete for Iran because she believes that can open the door for other Iranian women. But there's a duality within that. And I think that that's something that is really down to that earlier discussion around, you know, telling women what they can or cannot wear. What is equality? Really, it's, you know, true equality and true freedom is that the individuals have the right to decide what is right for them and their morality, their religion, their culture, their country.
Wow. We look at ourselves as being so, in some cases, free and don't think about, I mean, I certainly don't think about, well, I do think about what I'm going to wear, but I don't mm-hmm. think about what I cannot wear.
Right.
Or what I can wear. And it's just interesting. They seem to accept it with such grace.
Right. And yet I find it fascinating because we do still have this issue in the West, in Canada and, you know, in Europe, in the United States, where what women wear often comes into play if there's a rape case. You know, well, she was wearing this, therefore she either was asking for it or she, you know, wanted unwanted attention or whatever that is. And I think that really it comes down to around the world, we're still having a discussion, and we're still finding barriers around women's right to simply choose what they are, who they are, and what they choose to wear and what they choose to do on an individual basis.
Well, I love this subject, even though I hate this subject. You know what I mean? It's one of the, speaking of dualities, I do want to talk about the women's cycling team in Afghanistan. It's been such an important part of who you are and what you do for a long time. What's happening with the Afghan women's cycling team right now?
Well, it's been kind of exciting because I came back from my most recent trip to Afghanistan in May and kind of was ready to walk away, mainly because of the corruption within the Cycling Federation and the Afghan Olympic Committee, the illegal behavior of the coach, and not really seeing a way through that because the women themselves didn't feel that they had the agency or they weren't sure who to trust. In terms of walking away from coach, they didn't want to lose their only opportunity to ride bikes when they're in the country, and therefore were willing to put up with essentially a situation that I kind of liken to a Stockholm syndrome, you know, where abusees won't leave the abusers. Well, in the last 2 weeks, that's radically shifted in that the girls have recognized that there is no way forward and that having the experience of racing in Europe for the first time, they raced in a Grand Fondo World Qualifier in France, their very first experience in such a race. Two of the girls podiumed in their age group, and then nothing, just this radio silence. You know, nothing's going forward. Coach is doing nothing. He's being, you know, blacklisted because of his corrupt and illegal behavior, and the girls are stuck in the middle. And finally, you know, there was that breathing room and we're going forward directly with the girls. So I'm going to essentially step in as an interim coach until we can find someone to be that person on the ground in Afghanistan and work with the legitimate Afghan Cycling Federation, which has evolved and does not involve the coach. And really, two of the girls have expressed the direct desire to make it to 2020 Tokyo. So we had a long talk via Facebook Messenger, and we're going to go forward with that. And that means training camps outside of the country, but in the region. So UAE, Iran, Turkey, areas where they can easily get visas to, because it's very difficult for them to get visas to the U.S. or to Europe right now with, one, the refugee crisis and the potential for flight risk perceived by the State Department, that they wouldn't come back. And so we're looking at the region where there are areas that are safe for the girls to ride, but where we can also get coaches and trainers in to work with them so that we can actually, for the very first time, get them to a more elite level. And they're hungry for it. They're expressing their desire for it. So we're looking at a four-year plan, pulling in partners and sponsors and all of that, which we thought we were walking away from, and working with a small number of girls to prepare them for local races in the region, the Asia Games, and then the 2020 Tokyo, as well as then continuing what has been working very, very well on the ground, which is the social component of the piece of the project, which was always just getting local girls on bikes. And girls are starting bike clubs, and there's another team that has formed in another province. So bike deliveries and just supporting these girls that are riding and defying the taboo on a grassroots level, just wanting to ride to school. So we're continuing to do that. I've never walked away from that. But now there's a way forward with the national team, which makes me incredibly excited and a little bit adrenalized and hyper.
Really? You, of all people?
Yes. Who knew?
So who is supporting this? How are you getting funding to get bikes, to get equipment, to get, to get these girls educated? Obviously, they still want their educations.
Exactly. So it's really going back to the sponsors that have partnered with us in major ways in the past. And the two key sponsors in the past have been an international law firm, ironically, Hogan Lovells. They have branches all over, and they had kind of helped us navigate, looking at visas and other issues, but they've also contributed financially to help support the team. And then, of course, Live Cycling has been our partner for 3 years now. The hope is that they would continue to be our partner in the years ahead. And especially now that we have a clearly defined goal. And then really it's looking at some of our smaller sponsors or smaller partners that we've had, which have been Osprey Packs and Scratch Labs, to really brainstorm with us. How can we reach out to others that are within their circles, because we are essentially at a rebuilding stage. We're essentially at ground zero, zero money in the bank. We haven't done any pitches because I didn't know how we were going to be able to financially support them. And I've been very vocal about the corruption, even to the extent of doing an interview for the New York Times about it. So I didn't want to be pitching for partners and sponsors and money until I knew we had a bypass for the corruption, so everyone knew they could trust us going forward, of how that money would benefit the girls and not get railroaded in country. So now we have a way forward, and it's a matter of, okay, bike industry, okay, outdoor industry. These girls are National Geographic Adventures of the Year themselves, and they're Nobel Peace Prize nominees this year. Right. We need to get behind them, and we need to find the funding, and we need to get them new bikes. And, this is a major push, but we've got 4 years.
Yeah, but 4 years flies by.
It does. Exactly. Exactly. So we need our partners on board now, and we need to really pull together, a tangible, plan that we can get these girls training outside of Afghanistan and train one of the girls, Masuma, who has expressed interest for the past 2 years about becoming a coach, getting her professional training to be the coach in country. So that there is female leadership for the years ahead.
Could she leave the country to learn coaching?
She could.
Interesting.
Yeah, she could.
That sounds like an opening for somebody who might be listening, yes?
Yes, I hope so.
I hope so, too.
Who wants to sponsor Masuma?
Let's get her some coaching. So what is the organization? So is it still Mountain to Mountain? Is that how people will find out more, or is there something new?
It is. No, the last thing I wanted to do is reinvent the wheel. Mountain to Mountain has, you know, has been there on the ground for almost a decade now, and with these girls for three and a half years now, almost four. So, you know, the structure will remain that so that we can operate through that how we always have. The difference is, although it's not a huge difference, it's essentially how am I controlling the money and how are we going forward with the partners on the ground, meaning the Afghan Cycling Federation and the Afghan Olympic Committee. You know, they will not receive any money from us. We will be training the girls directly. And when there are opportunities to race, we will be funding that directly. We will not be sending them money to send girls or not send girls as what has happened in the past. So it's just finding more back doors and finding ways to bypass corruption. And this is in a country that is one of the two most corrupt countries in the world. So it's always been an issue, but it's always about finding the bypass.
Well,
never say die.
Never say die. That's it. Well, once again, fascinating story of what's going on. You know, I feel like I live in a bubble sometimes, but I read all that you do and I follow what you're doing. I love the program. I love the passion. Thank you so much for talking with us about it today. I hope that your friends in Kabul, you know, can find some peace and some quiet.
No. Thank you for always kind of checking in and having me on to talk about it. It's fun to be able to discuss it and come at it from a variety of angles like we did today.
Right, exactly. Well, take care. We will stay in touch and we'll follow Mountain to Mountain. Thanks, Shannon.
Thank you so much, Diane. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. My interview with Shannon Galpin originally aired August 27, 2016. So we'll take another real quick break and we'll close out our New Year's Eve show with Maynard Hirshhorn's heartfelt story, Nice Wheels. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We're back. Here's our story, Nice Wheels by Maynard Hirshhorn. I love it. It's a favorite. One of my very good friends, personally, he is one of my friends. His name is Maynard Hirshhorn. You've heard from him before. He has what we have both decided is a good story for these upcoming holidays. So we'll bring Maynard back. Maynard, it's so nice to talk to you. As always, thanks for joining us this evening.
Great to be here, Diane.
And it's wonderful to talk to you again. I'm very excited. I know the story you're going to tell this evening, and it's a great story that every cyclist, every bike shop owner, everybody in the industry will be able to relate to, and it's a feel-good story. Are you ready?
I am.
Okay.
Thanks, Diane. This is called Nice Wheels. Bob turned the sign to closed and clicked off the outside light. He went back to the bench and the stand and the half-trued wheel. Last one out of there as usual, he thought, turning the wheel a quarter turn each way, not yet touching it with the tool. He liked working after closing without noise or distractions or people waiting for their stuff. He liked knowing he could think about whatever he wanted to and could take his time with the work. No clock ticking. He heard tapping at the door, saw it was Eric, and motioned him to come in. Not locked, he mouthed, nodding and making door-opening movements. Eric came in looking puzzled. He had a Camping YOLO box tucked under his arm. Hubs, maybe. I was rooting around in the dumpster for an old rim to stretch a saw up on, and look what I found, Eric said, and handed Bob a Chorus hub set, 9-speed, 32H scrawled on the top in black marker, Bob's writing, and one of Bob's price tags stuck on the end. Eric shook his head, wearily waved goodnight, and left. Unwilling to believe what he saw, Bob stared at the box. He looked up at the shelf where the hubs should have been, and by golly, they weren't there. No. Until a moment ago, they were in the dumpster. Only someone working for me would leave this box in the dumpster after sneaking it out of the store. Anyone else would have taken these hubs right home. An employee might leave them out there, then come back after closing, after midnight maybe, and grab them when no one would see. If someone found them out there, it could be an accident. Why, they must have fallen into the wastebasket by mistake and ended up in the dumpster with the rest of the junk. Sure, lucky you found them. Geez, Bob said out loud, someone's taken stuff from the shop. Whoever did this wouldn't leave that box out there longer than they had to, he thought. Must have been someone who worked today. Imagining one of his guys stealing, having to play detective and figure out who it was, made Bob tired. I don't want to do this, he thought. I sell the guy's stuff 10% over cost. If they can't pay now, they pay little by little out of their checks. If they need to borrow something of mine, they know they just have to ask. If they need my help, whatever it is, they just have to ask. Especially if they're riding their bikes a lot, riding every day or training and racing. I'll do about anything to help. Still, here was serious evidence that one of his guys was stealing. Bob opened the box and took out the rear hub. He turned the axle and felt the grease-slowed smoothness of the bearings, spun the cassette body, and listened to the Paul's ratchet inside. He pulled his Sutherland's manual down from the shelf above the bench and leafed through it, found the pages he wanted, and did some arithmetic in pencil inside the lid of the Campy box. He bent down to boxes under the bench and counted out butted stainless spokes in three links, dunked the threaded ends into a bottle of spoke prep. He tamped the wet ends on a rag and spread the spokes out on the bench to dry. He scooped a handful of spoke nipples out of another box, found two 32-hole Mavic Aero clincher rims, and unwrapped them, laying them gently on the bench. He laced spokes onto both of the Campy hubs, threaded the spokes into the holes in the rims, and screwed on the nipples a few turns. Once, while he was mindlessly starting nipples onto spokes, he found himself wondering who the hell had taken the hubs. He made himself stop thinking like that. Stop, Bob! And went on building the wheels. He took the customer's wheel out of the stand and hung it on a hook. He chucked the newly laced front wheel into the stand and took his time making it fine, tight, and true. He took it out of the stand and squeezed the spokes together. He put the wheel on the floor to stress it out, then put it back in the stand and touched it up, just right. He got a Velox cotton rim strip and a Phillips screwdriver. He put the Phillips through the valve hole in a tape and the valve hole in the rim, then stretched the tape around the rim, tight and straight. He dusted the rim strip with talc, found two lightweight tubes and two light folding road clinchers. He sprinkled talc on the tube, put one of the tubes and one of the tires on the rim. He put in 40 pounds with a floor pump, checked the bead, and ran it up to 100. He built the rear wheel in the same methodical way, installed the other rim strip, tube, and tire, and put in 110 pounds per square inch. He found a 1223 Campy cog set, lightly greased the cassette body, slipped the cogs and spacers on, and tightened the lock nut. "Nice wheels," he said, and they were nice wheels. He chucked the customer wheel back in the stand so he'd remember to work on it first thing. He turned off the fluorescence above the shop and rechecked that the back door was locked. He got his jacket and tidied up the bench, turned out lights, turned on other lights, walked to the front door and set the alarm. Carrying the fine new wheels out with him, he turned to lock the door within the seconds the alarm allowed. He peered through the glass, past the Power Bar sticker and the Oakley sticker and the GT sticker, and saw that all was just as it should be. As he passed the dumpster on the way to his old truck, he lifted the lid and gently put the wheels inside. As he lowered the lid, glare from a streetlight glinted off one of the hubs. Nice wheels, he thought. And they were nice wheels.
That story. For the listeners who just heard that story, that was Maynard Hirshhorn telling the story of these wheels. It is a fabulous story. Any bike shop owner can relate to that story and go, "Oh, if I only I could be that bike shop owner, you know, to have that kind of sense of oneself, to take the hubs, make a perfect pair of wheels and set them back in the dumpster and go home and feel like that was the right thing to do." What a cool story, Maynard.
It was better than the right thing to do, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was. It was the only thing to do to make it right in your own mind. That was amazing.
Thanks, Ryan.
I loved it. I am glad you are writing again. Writing a lot, I hope.
At least two stories a month.
Yes.
And sometimes three.
And so how can people read your news stories?
They can log on to bicyclepaper.com.
Okay.
And they can read my latest column, and they can read archive columns, I think, back several years.
Awesome. Just awesome.
On that site.
So it's really nice to be able to have the kinds of stories you've read for us the last couple of times you've been on the show.
Well, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. It feels right for me to come on and read every once in a while.
I think it's great.
It.
And we enjoy having you. So I hope you have lots of good stuff for your Thanksgiving. This Thanksgiving. And I hope you take us up on the offer to come east. I mean, you know, we will throw Maynard a party. We would love
That'd
that.
Be wonderful.
And ride with you too.
Super.
All right. Have a wonderful evening. Thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Good night, Diane.
Good night, Maynard.
Greg.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
As always, that story is worth hearing at least once a year, maybe twice. It makes me feel really good about bike shops. It makes me feel really good about the work that we do. That's it for 2016. Wow, it's been a great year for this outspoken cyclist. I thank you so much for listening to the show, for all the kind words and great conversations that have been started by you on Facebook, Twitter, and via email. Keep visiting us on our social media platforms. Remember, if you have a chance and it's nice where you are, go for a ride. We'll talk again in 2017. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.